Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening once again, everyone, and welcome to the Fighting Network, a Wednesday night edition of our sports conversation. We look forward to it each Wednesday night, and I hope you do as well. As always, we got the same group of people leading the way. Roy Cummings is in Tampa. Roger Hendler is in Philly, but about to go back to Atlanta for a stay over there. And Frank Cal is our executive producer. And the Philadelphia Eagles are going to be in the news for a couple of reasons this week. The best game of the week, obviously, will be Monday night. But also, we're going to find Jim Gallagher, a longtime Eagle executive. And Frank, you got a little dedication for him before we get started.
Yeah, it's Jim Murray, remember, John. Jim has been with the Eagles for many, many years. He served fantastic. He was fantastic in business. He did a great job as general manager of the Eagles. And then he started a nonprofit called the Ronald McDonald House. Ronald McDonald House is now in 57 states around the country, and it's all because of things that he's done and put together. Tomorrow, the good people of Philadelphia will have a chance to help out. They're having a marathon TV program It starts at 7 o'clock in the morning and goes through till 7 o'clock at night so people can make a donation. Remember, this is a program where people are at their very, very lowest. Their child is in serious condition. Some may, and they're waiting for cancer programs. Some of them are fatal. But they're given a house, they're given a room and board at the Ronald McDonald House, and there's no cost. There's absolutely no cost. You also have a chance to give in a construction for the house while you're there. We had the pleasure of using the.
You're breaking up, Brian. You're breaking up.
It's not me, Don.
Go ahead.
It's Roger. We had the pleasure of using the McDonald House here in Tampa in 1999 when my daughter was almost killed in a car accident. We were there. She was there 31 days in the neurointensive care unit, and they let us stay at the house the whole time. It really made getting back and forth to the children's hospital easier. We met a lot of nice friends, and I can't say enough about the program or about Jim. He was always a gentleman and always somebody I looked up to. So good luck.
No question about it. Jim's really done a terrific, terrific job, and it was really piloted, too, by the Philadelphia Eagles owner. And, of course, they got involved in it in the early days, just take up collections, and then it bloomed into exactly what Frank is talking about right now. A full-fledged Ronald McDonald Houses all around the country, started by the Philadelphia Eagles and the Philadelphia Eagles owner, and a terrific job by Jim at the same time. All right, let's get our program underway. We'll go down to Tampa, Florida first. And now we've got some great games coming up this weekend. Philadelphia Eagles, obviously, Kansas City, they start a four-game spread against some very, very difficult teams with a record where they've only lost one game and a two-game lead on the Dallas Cowboys. And, of course, the other thing we want to talk about at the very top, tough blow for Cleveland because Deshaun Watson, I should say, is going to be out. Let's go to Tampa, Florida, and Roy Cummings. Roy, go ahead.
Good weekend ahead. So as you said, some good matchups. So Monday night will be the crown jewel of the matchups. We'll see if it's a great game or not, but it should be. I don't think there's a lot of really good NFL teams this year. The NFL is, I'd say, down a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of mediocre teams out there, but the Chiefs and the Eagles are not two of them. I think, despite the fact that we've talked about it several times, the Eagles, not having played their best football yet, they are still, I think, one of the three or four elite teams that are in the league. Chiefs are probably the best of the bunch. You could make an argument for San Francisco, but they came back to earth a little bit over the course of the past month, but then looked very good last Sunday. We'll see how they do against Tampa. Should be I wouldn't say an easy victory for them, but they should win that one. And although Tampa's, played pretty well at times, too, and, they've shown an ability to win games. They haven't shown an ability to upset a good team yet, so that would be a step forward. But clearly the biggest game is Kansas City and the Eagles, and we'll see how that rematch of the last Super Bowl plays out.
And, Roger, you're right there in Philadelphia. I imagine a lot of hype for this particular game as well. Also, talking about what's happening in Philadelphia. A lot of highs this year between the baseball and the football. And one thing about the Eagles, they keep getting up there, and they've only lost one game, but they scared a lot of people in Philadelphia with the way they perform game in and game out, Roger.
Yeah, excuse me, every week. But, I'll tell you, Roy, I don't know if the Chiefs are the best team, to be honest with you. Well, they have three losses, and, they are the defending champion. But I don't know if the best team in the NFL has surfaced yet. I really don't. And I think, this game coming up could be, and I mean, look at the way the Cowboys took care of the Giants. But the Giants, they are not a very good team. So, and they're awful. I mean, but there's a lot of awful. Look at that game that was in Frankfurt on Sunday morning. I mean, you know, who would want an NFL franchise when you saw a lousy game like that? But, you know, I think that the best team will surface probably in December, and then we'll know for sure who the best team is. And it may be the Eagles, and it may be the Chiefs, maybe the 49ers, and it may be Dallas. Who knows? I mean, I was surprised that Jacksonville lost on Sunday the way they had been playing, but you know, that's the NFL on any given Sunday or whatever day, anybody can beat the other team.
Well, I certainly won't argue with you the point that it's hard to know who the best team really is, because you're right. We've yet to see a team play at an extremely high level consistently. We've seen a lot of teams play at a mediocre level consistently, and we've seen several teams play at a very poor level consistently. But you're right. I mean, as we said many times, I just noted that the Eagles probably haven't hit their stride yet. The Chiefs with the three losses. You know, I just think of all the teams, I think the Chiefs probably just have, not just because they're the defending champions, but I just think they can probably overcome the issues more than anyone. I think they're deeper than most teams. But still, yeah, as you said, December will probably tell us who it is, or, you know, there's a very good chance we could go through the entire season, 17 games, and really never get a feel for who the best team is, and then end up with a matchup of who knows. You know, I mean, you can make an argument for the Baltimore Ravens being the best team in the league. So,
yeah,
you know, who knows what we're going to see in the – what we're, it could be a Dallas-Baltimore Super Bowl. That could certainly happen. It wouldn't surprise me because, you know, the way it's going, clearly anything can happen. No one has really stepped up and said, hey, we're the team to beat here. I mean, you look at what Buffalo did the other night. You know, a lot of people had counted Denver out, and rightfully so. But, you know, now they're coming back to life, and Buffalo is struggling. So, you know, we'll just see. It's kind of like that throughout the league. It's, in my opinion, the product has not been very good this year. There might be four or five teams out there that have the ability to play at a high level and will reach that distinction at some point. But right now, there aren't too many doing it.
You're right.
And also, fellas, let's go right back down to your bailiwick. The 49ers coming in, they had a really down spell there for a couple of weeks, and they bounced back last week and got a big win. And I think this is a very, very big game for the Buccaneers. The Buccaneers will either be in or out, I think. And if they can make a good showing against the 49ers, which I believe will be very, very tough, your opinion?
Yeah, I think this is a big game for the Bucs for a couple of reasons. First of all, they could lose this game and still win the division. That's not an issue. The division is still soft. There's no doubt about that. They've still got games against Carolina, another one against New Orleans, another one against Atlanta. So, you know, they can still – the schedule still favors the Bucs. If you want them if you consider them to be a division champion contender, and I think they are, again, just because of the division, but you can say that about every division, really. But the opportunity for the Bucs right now is to prove once again, they have this opportunity again to show that they can beat what most people consider to be an elite team. You know, there's probably, as we said, three, four, five elite teams at best in the league, and they couldn't do it against the Eagles, couldn't do it against Buffalo, and they can't do it. And so let's see what happens here against San Francisco. Can they win this game? You know, look, the way San Francisco has played of late, you could say, you know, I think the Bucs have a chance. Now, they've got to correct some things. They've got to get their running game going. I think they've got to get Rashad White out in space a little bit more. They've proven, they figured out that that's where he's best. They got to stop giving up big plays on defense against the run and the pass. But at the end of the day, you know, Baker Mayfield has put this team in contention. They've got enough weapons to hang with anybody offensively. If the defense can hold and they can get, you know, they don't make mistakes on special teams, well, they could post an upset. I think that's quite possible, and I'm not calling it. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I do think I'll be surprised if the Bucs don't give the 49ers a good game. I think it's going to be a one-score game at the end of the day. And I think it's going to come down to the last 4 or 5 minutes of the fourth quarter before it's decided. So I think the Bucks are that good, and I think, you know, they've had a couple of weeks here to figure things out from their bye week and to kind of hone in on the issues that they know they have to correct. And I think if they can get into practice and get some things done there, they could just upset San Francisco. At the very least, I think they'll give them a game.
Roger, you're heading back to Atlanta. We had high hopes for Atlanta before the season got underway, and things have not worked out their way at all.
Well, they haven't. They've had ups and downs, and they're still trying to figure out who the quarterback is. And, you know, they were high on the kid, but now, you know, everything I hear is that now there's a lot, he's a suspect. The thing I think Arthur is fascinated about now is his own job, because this is third year and they really have not taken steps forward. Now, you can also blame the general manager on the drafting, et cetera. But the one, the draft pick that I've seen on TV, I do not understand why he is not used more. And that's kid that went to Miami from Kyle Pitts. And I just don't get it. I mean, that kid is supposed to be a stud. And, you know, he doesn't get that many passes thrown to him. And he was supposed to be like one of the great ends. And I don't understand. I think that Arthur Smith has made some, and Roy, you probably see more games because of being down in Florida than we see. But some of his play calling is really suspect.
Yeah, and I think the system is a bit suspect. And, you know, it's clear to me that they're not really playing to the strengths of what they have, at least on the offensive side of the ball. You're right. Pitts is a player who you can, you know, build an offense around. Very few offenses are built around tight ends, but let's face it. We certainly saw Tom Brady, win 4 or 5 Super Bowls because he featured his tight end a lot. And I think the Falcons should have been doing the same thing. You got two young players there at quarterback and at tight end that you can really just feature. And you know, Pitts, I think he's one of those guys who you can split him out wide if you want. You can put him in the slot. You can put him on the line. He's just that kind of guy. And, an elite caliber tight end. And he's got that ability, but, you know, we just haven't seen it. And again, I think you're right. I think it's a result of the scheme. And I don't think the scheme is geared towards the tight end. It's, you know, just a – I'm not going to say it's a basic scheme, but it's just your ordinary scheme that basically features, you know, runs and passes to the outside. And the tight end is, you know, an occasional decoy, and he'll get the ball if everybody else is double covered. So, but I think it really needs to work the other way. And so I think what you're seeing develop there is probably a need to make some changes in the off season. I think talent wise, Atlanta has some pieces there, and I think they've got the foundation of building something. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take another draft or two, but I think they've got the pieces if they, you know, are willing to take advantage of those pieces and make use of them. I think that's what they've got to do, and I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yep.
Before we jump over to another sport, any comment from you two about Deshaun Watson? I mean, Cleveland, they've been trying so hard to get a team together that can win. They won a game at the Wire Sunday. Deshaun Watson really led them all the way down. Roger, any comment about before we jump to another sport?
Well, no. You know, I've been a Watson fan for many years because I broadcast his games at Gainesville High School when he was a freshman sophomore. And he had a great career at Clemson, as we know, and got his degree in 3 years, and then ran in a foul with some personal issues off the field, which really knocked him out for more than a year. And now I think I know he got hurt, but I guess you're saying that he's finished for the year, right, Don, because of the injury. I had not seen that yet.
I believe that's the case. I haven't gotten the full report yet, but I believe that's the case.
Yeah, he's got a broken bone in his throwing shoulder, guys, and the belief is that the surgery is gonna require more recovery time than what's left in the season.
So, right.
Yeah, it looks like he is done for the year now. You know, maybe if they made the playoffs and they went deep, he could somehow be back. I don't think that's the case. I just think there's too much rehab. Again, it's, you know, so I don't think it's going to happen. But, you know, I guess I feel bad for the player. I do. I feel bad for the player. Feel bad for the Browns. But, you know, based on Deshaun Watson's recent history, I don't feel too bad.
Not a lot of sympathy, right, Roy?
Let's put it this way: if I was the owner of an NFL team, I never would have signed Deshaun Watson. I don't care how good he is. I never would have signed him. I let somebody else do that. The Browns did it. You know, some people are saying this is karma. I don't know about that, but
and high numbers,
you know,
dude. How do we just sign them? High numbers,
guaranteed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, let's switch to another sport. You're bailiwick, Roy, and you've been talking about Edmonton all year, and the cracks in the armor came out very quickly this week. I mean, they didn't wait very long to get rid of a coach to make a completely change. They got off to a terrible start, and you thought they were money in the bank starting the season.
Well, I thought they were money in the bank to be one of the better teams in the league. I'm not in the group that thought this was a Stanley Cup finalist. Because from the very beginning, and this is one of the reasons I'm a little bit surprised that the fire, you know, that they fired the coach, John Woodcroft, because here's the thing. I've never thought going into this season and even last year, the year before, I've never thought that Edmonton had the goaltending to get deep enough into the playoffs to win a Stanley Cup. And I know that they don't have the defensive structure to go there. They don't have the edge. When you look at teams that are getting deep into the playoffs and winning Stanley Cups nowadays, they have an edge to them. They have elite-level goaltending, and they're pretty deep defensively. They don't necessarily – I'm not talking about having seven or eight, you know, defenders, but you've got four or five at least. And you can cover up for some mistakes, and you've got a structure that keeps the puck out of your net. None of that is present in Edmonton. They've got arguably the two best players in the game today, in Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid. They've got, you know, other pieces that are just fabulous, and most of it works pretty well for the most part. But, you know, 5-on-5, you know, penalty kill, defensive, you know, in a tight checking game, they're going to lose more often than they're going to win. And so I'm not surprised that they, you know, I'm not surprised at all that they got off to the start they got off to, because if you take Draisaitl and McDavid out of the equation, and that's kind of what happened late in Woodcroft's tenure over the last, you know, 6-8 games here, was that those guys kind of lost confidence. They were struggling anyway. And that just led to this team just being unable to produce in, you know, in any way offensively. And if they can't produce offensively, well, they're not going to win the 3-2 games. They're not going to win the 2-1 games. They're going to lose those games 5-2, you know, 4-2. And that's what was happening. And I don't know that, you know, the new coach, Chris Knobloch, is going to make much of a difference. First of all, I mean, it's good that he had Connor McDavid and Junior. That's great. He is the best player, and you got to figure out a way to get him going again. And, you know, again, Edmonton has proven that they can be a playoff team with just two guys going. But he's going to have to change the structure there. And I don't know that they have the horses to do it. You know, if they're going to play a forechecking style, which I think is part of the plan, you know, start to create off the forecheck a little bit, maybe that works. But do you have the forecheckers to do it? It's going to take a while for them to figure this out, to kind of restructure things. But the good news is this. They did make the move early. I won't say it was unwarranted. But at the end of the day, we have seen in the last couple of years, saw St. Louis about 3 years ago go to the Stanley Cup Finals after being in last place, literally, in the league or in their division. on January 1st. And then last year, Florida, which was, you know, foundering late in the season at the same time, you know, January, February, coming to life late. So, you know, they've got, in essence, they've got about a month here to figure this out. The West is not that strong when you get, you know, when you get deep into it. Colorado's going to be tough. Vancouver's playing extremely well. We'll see if they can keep it up. You know, but if they can get to a point where they're above water against the Winnipegs and Arizona and St. Louis, teams like that, then you only have to worry about, Colorado, Dallas, Vancouver. I mean, everybody else in that West is, LA's playing well. But pretty much everybody else in the West isn't quite ready to go deep into the playoffs either. So there's an opportunity for Edmonton to figure this out. I think it's one of the reasons they went ahead and made the move when they did. Shake it up now, see if you can make some changes and get this thing back on the rails.
Roger, before we come back to Roy and talk about his hometown team, the Lightning, who seem to be flattering around the 500 mark, we'll talk to him about that one. But we look at what happened with the Rangers, the Islanders, and you're right there in Philly. The Flyers are having a tough time. They're floundering around that 500 mark.
Well, yeah, but I'll tell you what, Don. They have had a pretty good road trip on the West Coast, and I think they were 5-7, and they're now at 500. So
right.
they had some really good wins. One of them very surprising, but Tom LeMain has said continuously that they're going to get better, and I agree with that. And John Tortorella seems to be very happy with the way they're playing. So I think they will get better as the season progresses. I was really excited after I saw two losses on the games I attended. And then they go in the West Coast, and son of a gun, they turn it around, and they're looking a heck of a lot better.
Roy, you had a tough night last night, and of course, they've lost their goaltender until later on in the season. We've talked about that week in and week out. But John Cooper is having a little trouble getting them out of the gate.
Yes, he is, and I'll tell you what, guys. I was at the game on Saturday night against Carolina, where they got shut out, and then they get shut out again two nights in a row. That hasn't happened in a long time here in Tampa. But I'll tell you what, this situation in Tampa, it goes deeper than Andrei Vasilevsky's goal. It goes deeper than having missed Nikita Kucherov against Carolina on Saturday night. This team looks quite lost right now, and I think part of it is I just don't think they have the horses to play the style that John Cooper wants them to play anymore. I applaud the moves that they've made in the off season. I think picking and late last season, I think they picked up good players, guys that are the kind of guys that you need to go deep into the playoffs with and to win a lot of games with. They're not household names. I mean, nobody knows who Tanner Jeannot is, unless you really follow the game. You don't know who Michael Essiemont is, guys like that. But, these guys are Connor Sheary, this type of player. But these are guys who can help you win. But you've got to be in the right system. And right now, I just don't know that Tampa's playing the right system for these guys. They've got to shake that up a little bit, and I don't know that John Cooper has the answer as to how to do that. You can't just kind of, they've done a better job of late of not, kind of leaving their goaltender, on his own, because that's what they were so accustomed to with Vasilevsky. But they really haven't figured out, just how to attack offensively. I mean, the other night at the game, I mean, they're struggling with the basics, struggling with the basic breakout, struggling with the basic regroup, struggling with the basic entry into the offensive end. And they're really, really struggling to hold on to the puck offensively. And, once they get into the offensive end, part of that is because some of the guys they have just don't have that kind of skill set that some of the other players that they used to have did have. The good news is Vasilevsky, I think, is within a month of coming back. I think you're going to see him before Christmas, and that'll give the Lightning a boost for sure. Just 5-on-5, they got some things they got to figure out. And, So we'll see where it goes. But I think we found out that John Cooper is not quite as good a coach as he seemed to be. Again, this is the guy who never won the Jack Adams, and there's probably a reason for that. And, you know, one of the reasons is a lot of people will say that coaches in the NHL are just as good as their goaltenders. And when you got the best in the league, well, your team usually goes pretty far. And that's what's happened. But, of late we've seen what the Lightning are really made of. And right now they don't look to be that strong. But they got time to figure it out.
Well, fellas, on the baseball front, Brandon Hyde, I thought, was a great selection for manager of the American League. And, of course, Skip Schumaker in the National League. And I thought both choices were good. I know there was a little bit, Bruce Bochy got 3 votes, I think. Roger, what'd you think about the 2 managers selected for managers of the year?
Well, I thought they were good choices. I would have thought that Bruce Bochy would have gotten more votes because I think it's great. You come out of retirement where you're coaching your grandchildren's team and now you win a World Series championship. But, you know, there's a lot of politics in everything, as we know. I thought the selection, an MVP, and I'm surprised that Bryce Harper got the Silver Slugger for being the designated hitter because he played first base, not that much. So if you look at it from the time that he came back, he did was the DH, but. What I think is going to be interesting is how this free agency goes. I mean, it's going to start picking up. A lot of speculation Aaron is going to go to the Braves. That'll be very interesting if that happens. So, we'll just have to wait and see. There's more awards coming, but I thought they were the managers of the year were very, they were deserving.
Yeah, we'll hear about Cole tonight, whether he gets for the Yankees. Of course, we're looking forward to that one. Roy, your thoughts about the 2 selections?
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. Here's the thing. The votes come in before the season ends, and just as the season was ending, the Rangers were kind of struggling a little bit. There was a lot of question as to whether, how good were they going to be in the playoffs? Can they suddenly figure this out? And, it's not that easy to just put Corey Seager's name at the top of the batting order right behind Marcus Semien every night and let him go to town and, with his MVP caliber type season. So, that is no knock on Bruce Bochy. So, but Brandon Hyde, I don't have a problem. I thought both of the Manager of the Year awards were solid choices and, happy for both managers. I don't think Bruce Bochy's upset that, he didn't get it because he got the ultimate prize, and I'll leave you guys with that. At the end of the day, Bruce Bochy, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame too, and he's got another World Series ring, so it's worked out real well for him. So, guys, appreciate you having me for another week, and we'll do it again next week. We'll break down the Bucks and Niners and the Eagles and Chiefs.
I'm looking forward to it, Roy, and thank you as always every week of the entertaining and information network from you. So thank you
You're
very much.
Role.
And Roger, you and I saw a couple of basketball games last night. We don't want to talk about the NBA, but Sixers 8-game win streak went to went down the drain. They lost handily last night at home, and they're playing the Boston Celtics right now up at the Boston Garden.
We also saw
an outstanding college game. You're very familiar with Drexel. The Drexel Dragons played an awfully good game against Temple and already lost by 2 points.
Well, I watched some of that. You watched the whole thing and let me know what was going on at the end. Had a discussion today in school with several people about some of the, and one's a coach, about some of the other games. How about Penn beating Villanova, Don? After what, losing to St. Joe's, and then they beat Villanova, and the coach I was speaking about and I both believe that Jay Wright's successor is on a very short leash. And it's really going to take somebody a lot more pizzazz and to come in there and get things turned around. I mean, he's only in his second year. I understand that. But, you know, it's the old story. You don't want to be the guy or woman who replaces the legend. You want to be the person that replaces the person who replaced the legend. You know, and we saw that so many times. And it's amazing. The one good thing is the Big Five, even though it's a Big Six, really has had some great games, and it's really exciting to see that fans are attending and fans are talking about it again. That's great news.
Well, we certainly hope so, because they went through a period of time. I talked to Phil Martelli last night, as a matter of fact. His Michigan team did a terrific job at the Garden a couple of nights back. I don't know how many people had a chance to see it on Monday night, but Michigan played St. John's, and, you know, it was the return of big-time basketball at St. John's and playing at Madison Square Garden, and Phil Martelli in Michigan just took them right out of the game from the opening toss, and it was a terrific game for Michigan, so I had a chance to talk to Phil. And I don't know how many people know that Phil's been has been replacing his the head coach, because head coaches had heart problems, and so Phil's sort of filling in, waiting. And I talked to him, and he's got a guard. I can't think of his name now right now, but boy, well, best guard he's had since he was at St. Joe's. I mean, what a terrific player, and what a terrific game. Also, last night, more trouble in the NBA at Donnybrook. Between the Golden State Warriors and I think it was Timberwolves, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't seen the video of it, but I know that a lot of people are going to get suspended, and the NBA continues to have problems, Roger.
Hey, they sure do, and they just can't get out of their own way, it seems. And what's interesting is Don. I don't know if you saw. Reaction to fans on James Harden. They already want him out of town on the West Coast. So yeah. He no sooner gets there, and he's got everybody been out of shape, and they want him out of town, just like they did in Philadelphia. But I think the Sixers – go ahead.
Go ahead. No. You saw the Sixers, I did too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Sixers are a fun team to watch. And, you know, Tyrese Maxey, 50 points the other night. I think he ought to be showcased a lot more because I think he is the kind of player and has the personality totally opposite of Joel Embiid, where he could really – get people excited, and he's got that great personality and a big smile,
right.
And he's just the kind of kid that you you love, and I love watching him.
Joel Embiid didn't have a real good night last night, but as I said, the Sixers had won 8 in a row and came up a little bit short last night, but they came up short against a team that really played very well. I don't want to take anything.
Pacers are good. Yeah,
the Pacers
are very good.
So our listeners know, Roberto Leedy, or Carl Matthews.
You're breaking up, right? Is she going to be on, or is she doing something else?
No, her car broke down, and she can't get to – she's waiting for a tow truck to come get her. So,
okay.
That was that.
Young lady was going to join us. She's joined the LPGA, and we were going to talk a little women's. She just came back from Italy and wanted to see whether she had played on the course where they played the Ryder Cup. Sorry, we're going to miss her. And so what direction would you like to go, Frank?
She'll be on next week. Yeah, she's going to be on next week.
Okay.
I'm trying to get Phil Matthews. He was on next, but his phone keeps going to voicemail.
Bill was the official scorer for the World Series. Of course, a longtime baseball coach, college baseball coach, as well as the official scorer for the Tampa Bay Rays. And so hopefully he's supposed to join us tonight, too. So hopefully we get Bill. So Roger and I'll sort of kick it around until we find out whether we can get Bill or not.
Okay, I'll keep trying.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, the I know TL is not at the Flyers game because they're in Charlotte, in Carolina, against the Hurricanes. And once again, we want to congratulate Tom as we did last week. Friday night, he will be the man of the year in the Philadelphia Broadcast Pioneers. And Don was honored several years ago. You and Dan, I think, were on that same day. Is right, Don?
Exactly right. We went in at the same time, and just before the COVID, and of course the COVID shut down the honorary dinners at the Hilton Hotel in Philadelphia, and it shut down the Pioneers Hall of Fame. And, I'll tell you, a lot of great people in the Hall of Fame, and a lot of people that Dan Baker certainly was so well-deserving, and he went in the same night I did.
Well, he did, and I thought that, as you know, I was being the Ira Kaufman of the Broadcast Pioneers and pushing for you a long time ago, because you should have been in there a long time ago. You know, we want to have Mike Sielski on one time, and then we had a glitch and we couldn't have him on. Because he's on with Glenn Mack now on Saturday mornings, 10 to 1 on WIP. But he is working on a book that I can't wait to talk to him about. It's not out yet, but it's going to be on the history of the slam dunk. And I just think it's a fascinating subject, you know, because I can remember when I was in high school, to be able to dunk was like a real accomplishment. And I was 6'4", and I did it one time. And I got to tell you, I never came down from the clouds. And I was in a lot better shape than I am today, I can tell you that. But, you know, we saw, and now my nephew with Intersport runs that dunking and the three-point competition before the NCAA Final Four. And so this has become a whole new topic where today, I mean, last night you saw Embiid tried to make a slam dunk, but he didn't make it.
Just the heel of the rim and it shot out 20 feet.
Yeah, exactly. And but I just, you know, I'm looking forward. Mike's a great writer, great person. And I'm just looking forward to when he comes out with that, because, you know, it's always, you find a really good book about a subject you're interested in, because I can, and I'll tell you, our executive producer would know this fellow, because he went to his alma mater, Tom Galea, St. James, right, Frank? And I think 59, I think it was right around your time. And I can remember he could dunk at 5, and he was 5'10", as I recall. And that, in those days, was a real, real accomplishment. So,
the players are so big now, and so many of them can dunk. But I happen to be in the Wizard of Westwood. I happen to be in his class. I think they've ruined the game with the dunk. I think they're so concerned about hitting 3-point shots. And just as you said last night, you know, they're behind in the game, and all Jelly has to do is just lay it in. They were behind by, I think, only 5 points at the time, and he tries to do a windmill slam dunk, hits the back of the rim, ball goes out 20 feet, the Pacers pick it off and go down the other end of the floor, they have a layup, and the game's almost over. I mean, I know that most of the basketball fans love it. They love the dunk. But I think it ruins the game. I think it takes a lot away from playmaking. They don't do any playmaking. Either they shoot the three or they slam dunk. And I think that takes it away from the game itself and the NBA. And the other thing that has always disturbed me over the years is the fact that it's the only sport that you can play where – you intentionally foul to give yourself an advantage in the last couple of minutes if you're down.
Yeah.
And it's the only sport that you could do that. It's the only sport where you could intentionally foul somebody and try to gain an advantage. And I always thought that was a weakness of the game, too. But nobody else agrees with that, obviously. But
No, I do. Yeah, I do. And one of the greatest scoring performances I ever saw by an average height player was when I was living in Columbia, South Carolina. Kevin Joyce and the Gamecocks, Frank McGuire was the coach, and
right,
they had some really good team. Alex England,
great
Brian
player.
Winters.
Joyce was a great,
great
player.
Players. Yeah, that was a great team. And Kevin Joyce had 42 points against Indiana, and there was no three-point shot. And at the Final Four, Meadowlands, I was sitting a couple of rows in front of Bobby Crimmins, and he was one of the assistants for Frank McGuire on that team. And I talked to him about that, and he agreed with me because if you take the three-point line into effect, Kevin Joyce would probably have had over 50 points because, like, every one of his outside shots was a three-point shot. But he didn't look at it as going out because there was no three-point shot.
Right.
And it was just good traditional basketball, as we know Frank McGuire always played when he was coaching the Warriors or North Carolina or at South Carolina. You know, you had to be a fundamentally sound player to play on his team. Lenny Rosenbluth. At North Carolina, great player. Was okay in the pros. Didn't set the world on fire, but he had some great players. But that South Carolina team, I tell you, they were fun to watch. I got to see a lot of games too, living in Columbia. But they were just a terrific team to watch.
Well, I thought that the three-point play was very, very interesting because. In my mind was when they brought it into the game, they brought it into the game to give you an advantage to make a comeback by shooting three-point mm-hmm. shots. I don't think it was intended to start the first shot of the game to be a 35-foot shot. I mean, I don't think that was the intent of it. But unfortunately, it's turned into, and of course, Phil Mustick at the New York Post details it almost every week, some games 70 three-point shots. You know, I mean, it becomes now a three-point game. And as Sonny Hill told us a couple of weeks ago when he was on with us, he was always a proponent for the big guy in the middle. There is no post-game anymore. There's no Wilt Chamberlain. There's no Bill Russell.
No.
You know, there's no post-game in the NBA. And for the most part, there's no post-game in college. Now, I watched Kansas last night. And they have a young fella that's 7'2", that could easily be a post player. Great rebounder. I think he had 32 points and 22 rebounds last night as Kansas came back to beat Kentucky. But as I say, I thought it was a great innovation to give you a chance if you're 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 points back. You know, at the end of the game, you get a couple of threes and you're right back in it again. But I've always been just hesitant about saying, well, you know, the last 3 minutes of a game, all you're doing is watch people intentionally foul and hoping they miss. I mean, that's basically what it is.
Exactly. You know, I wanted to follow up with you, staying with even college basketball. Congrats to Phil Martelli for getting a well-deserved credit. For what he's done, because he had to fill in for the coach last year, too, I think,
correct.
A couple of games.
Yes, he did.
Right? But, I mean, every time he has filled in, they've played well. And we know what a great coach he is, and it's just really good. He's getting a big play in the Big Ten. So we love the guy, and he's a terrific guy. And I'll tell you, if you ever hear him, as a speaker, as he has been many times at the Philadelphia Sports Writers, he is funny. And that last line last year when he was there, he says something doesn't add up. Okay, he said Fran Dunphy comes out of retirement to be back on the bench, and Jay Wright goes into retirement to be out off the bench. You know, it's just
and that's
brought
absolutely
the house
true.
Down.
That's absolutely true. Jay Wright knew when to go.
Yeah, exactly. And
well,
and,
as I say, basketball is a great game, and I broadcast a lot of games. I love the game, but I just think they've just gotten it way, way, way out of control between trying to run some kinds of plays and just coming down and shooting a 3-point shot. And so many times if you're not having any success with a 3-point shot, you're just not going to win. It's as simple as that. But anyway, that's just my opinion, and it doesn't agree with most people.
Well, agrees with me, and I think when you're a traditionalist, and I think that's why I enjoy women's and girls' basketball. I was talking to one of the coaches, one of the girls' high school coaches, and he was saying, as pure athletes, the girls.
Roger, let me interrupt there because Bill Matthews is ready to go.
We got Bill. Great.
Great baseball coach, visual scorer, obviously, for the Tampa Bay Rays at the Trop, and has been for many, many years, and also official scorer for the World Series. Nobody knows more about baseball than Bill does. Bill Matthews, once again, thank you very much. I'm glad Frank had a chance to get a hold of you. We've been waiting very patiently to get some great information from you.
Well, I'll try not to disappoint, but I can't make any guarantees. I'm not sure what happened. Because my phone's been receiving calls all day, so there must be something funky in the air. How you guys doing?
Good, Bill. Always great to talk to you.
I'll let you lead it off, Roger. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I've been reading a lot about college baseball, and a friend of mine's son is a senior at West Forsyth High School. And he is going to a school, I believe, in North Carolina, Division III, to play. And they're excited about that. I'm excited because I know the young man. And I will tell you, so you can, in the future, his name is Seaver Spolin because his father is a Mets fan. And he was named after Tom Seaver.
Oh, my gosh.
We'll be hearing all about Seaver Spolin this year in high school and following years in his college career.
That's awesome. Tom Seaver was a special man, and I had the opportunity to face him in 1976 in a strike year exhibition game that we held at Eckerd College with a bunch of National League All-Stars who were working out with us during the week. And we played a game on a Saturday, and I had a chance to lead off against Tom Seaver, and it was a pretty amazing experience. I doubled down the left field line. I'm a left-handed hitter, so that tells you how quick my bat was. And in doing that, I got to second base, and he turned around and hit his cap to me, and I thought to myself, you know what? I could die right now, man. This is like the highlight of my career. 25 years later, I see him at the Don Cesar Hotel at an alumni event, and I had some balls with me, and I was getting them signed by guys. I had one left, and I went over to Tom with my wife, and I said, Tom, I'd like you to sign this for my son, Zach. And he signed it, and I said, I figured I'd go for it. I said, yeah, you're not going to remember this. But 25 years ago at Eckerd College, we played an exhibition game when you guys were locked out. And he looks at me, and he goes, hold on. He goes, double down the left field line, right? And my wife said, oh, my God, that was a true story.
That's great.
Well, Bill, tell us what you thought of the World Series. You saw it all, and it was a little shorter than most people wanted to see it, but it turned out the Rangers just turned out to be a much better team.
Well, it's really interesting. We had the discussions in college baseball about whether or not to have conference tournaments or just play the games and then go right to regional tournaments. And it's an interesting discussion because you give a team that didn't finish in their division, but they win a wild card and they get a chance to go to a postseason play, and they run through it and they win the World Series. That's the argument on the part of the teams that win a lot of games in our conference. It's the Tampas and the Florida Southerns, who win 30-plus games a year in a 33-game conference schedule. You don't want to keep playing the same teams in conference tournaments. You want to move on because you've already won the conference. You've already shown you can play over the long haul. But the Rangers proved that to be true. If you give a team a chance to get hot, and they get hot, they can win it all. And that's exactly what the Rangers did. It was pretty wild to watch it happen.
Roger?
Yeah, that's a good point, Bill, because there's a lot of people that feel that way about the wild card and about conference championships. After, like, you know, why did you win all your games except for two, win it going away, and then you get knocked out? I mean, the Braves were a perfect example this year. I mean, no doubt about it. But, no, I mean, it's a very good point. I can tell you that in Pennsylvania, it goes back to 1958 because I was in ninth grade, and Haverford High School won the state championship. And they had lost to Chester High School twice during the season. But they won by 1 point because the second-place team at that time in each league in the PIAA, they got to play in a tournament. And that Haverford won, and they went on. They won the state championship. But they were not the winner of their own league. So that was the end of that as far as the PIAA. They would never allow a second place team to ever play again in the state tournament.
Well, Bill, Larry Bowe was all last week, and we talked about this at great length. And Larry said that all they're doing is they're making a team that's won 100-plus games in the regular season worthless. He said they should at least change the system so that the number one team got to play the worst team in each playoff series, not to break it down the way they do now. He said they should at least get the right to play the weakest team in each playoff series, and I agree with that 100%. Make the fact that they won 100-plus games worth something, not that the regular season doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, you can't make a 162-game season essentially a toss-up when you get to the playoffs. I don't think that's fair to the best teams in the league. I also don't think it's right to put the best teams in the league in a position where they have to scratch and claw to advance. Making them play the worst team in the tournament, you know, that's still a pretty darn good team. So I think the argument is either drop the wild card, which would never happen because MLB wants to share the wealth and they wanted to give everybody a chance. And I think what they need to do is somehow, and I don't know how they could do it. I'm not a brackets kind of guy, but I agree with Larry, and somehow they have to set it up that the number one seed gets the softest, easiest, I don't know what the correct word is, team to face in every round. And I don't know bracket wise if you could actually pull that off, but I agree with Larry that would be the way to do it.
I do too. Roger?
Yeah, I also agree with that, and I think that something will come out of that in the future, but owners want to make money, and that brings more revenue in. But, you know, I think that you have to be fair or else look at the NBA. I mean, it's so bad as far as nobody really is interested. I mean, the real hardcore fan is, but the populace is not interested until they get into the playoffs as far as TV ratings go. And it's because they just have diluted it so much.
I think Draymond just made a lot of people interested. Draymond Green's actions last night, mm-hmm. I think he just made a lot of people really, really interested in the NBA. Did you see that video?
Mm-hmm. We talked about that earlier, Bill, and I'll tell you, he's been thrown out of more games. Green has he's a great player, but he's been thrown out. I think they said he was thrown out of 50-some games. I can't believe it.
he's unbridled. And there's no real equivalent to that in baseball. You know, baseball is more kind of a cerebral sport. I use Blake Snell winning, being what, the fifth guy to win Cy Young awards in both leagues. Fascinating, incredible. I mean, Brett.
Did he win it tonight?
He did win it. Yeah.
And how about Cole? Yeah. Did he win it in the American League?
Cole won it as well. Yes, sir.
They were just 2-1. They were heavy favorites that they were going to win it. But I hadn't heard the result yet on whether they had won it. What we were doing the show, and I didn't hear the result of whether they had won it. But they both did win.
Yes, sir. They're both Cy Young Award winners, and Snell is a free agent. So it's going to be interesting to see who puts the money up to cover his contract.
Bill, you're in on all the meetings. First of all, your evaluation of all the rule changes they made last year, your evaluation of what you thought of those, and would they make any changes? And number two, is there anything we can expect coming up this year that they haven't discussed yet?
No, I'll answer those backwards. There's nothing that is going to come up this year that's going to be new and different. I think they're still trying to give people a chance to get used to the rule changes as they are. My preference, I don't see the point in the throwing to first base rule. I think it opens the door. If you throw over twice, you know the guy's going on the third try. He's got an extended lead. Pitchers don't have good enough pickoff moves. They don't work on him enough. So he's going to go on the third pitch. I think that rule should be eliminated. I don't think pitchers throw over 6, 7, 8 times, much more than maybe 4 or 5 games in an entire season would they go extended throws to first base. So I think that's the only rule that if I were king for a day, I would probably get rid of that rule. I think the pitch clock is the greatest decision since 90 feet between the bases. It makes the game move so much more slowly. Quickly. It makes the batters get in there and swing the bat and get a feel for it. It makes the pitchers have to focus and hone in and get a feel. You know, hitting and pitching are feel kind of activities, and the longer time you have between each swing, the harder it is to execute that skill. So by having the pitch clock, it gets everybody in a rhythm, and I'm a huge fan. I think we only had 3 pitch clock violations at the drop this year and 2 batter violations not being set by the 8-second time limit. So, I mean, that's awesome. It's almost like, gosh, it's a pretty big game. I got to go home now. Kind of mentality.
You still like the ghost runner in extra inning games? You like that?
Well, I'm used to it in Florida because we do that. Well, the junior colleges in Florida actually instituted that. Daytona Beach Community College was the first school in Florida to do that back in the early 80s. We do it down here, so I'm kind of used to it. Do I like it at the big league level? No. But the main purpose behind doing it is saving pitchers' arms, not making them throw an exorbitant amount of pitches because there's so few great arms. And there's so much money invested in those arms. I think the rule is only made for that reason. It's not made for offense. It's not made to increase run production. It's made purely to save the arms of the pitching staff. So I can understand the mechanics and the analytics behind it. Do I like it? No. I mean, we did that when we played middle school kickball. The telephone pole was first base, you know.
I hear you, Bill.
Roger, go to it.
A couple of things, Bill. I know you're still involved with the college, even if it's just on a supporting basis. How did the recruitment class for this year, 23-24, how does it look? And of course, they're getting, I guess, playing fall ball now, right?
Yeah, I think the posting is going to be done this week. It's an interesting landscape right now because of COVID. You've got a lot of guys who are returning as super seniors or super seniors if they had a medical redshirt year already in there. So you've got some guys who are still playing at 22, some playing at the age of 23 if they're a super senior. So where does that leave the incoming freshman? Leaves them way down the totem pole.
Yeah.
So it puts a lot of pressure on the young kid, the 17 or 18-year-old kid, to play against the 23-year-old and compete for their position. You got to be a pretty darn good 17 or 18-year-old to do that anywhere in the country, never mind Florida, where, you know, everybody was a number three hitter when they were recruited out of high school and they came to Florida. So
right.
I think that changed the recruiting landscape. I think interesting demographic fact, the male population right now is the lowest it's been in 40 years in terms of college-age students. Our school is 70% female. All the private schools that are in our conference, we're an all-private school conference, every school is between 60 and 70% female. The scary thing is, in 3 years, when the 2008, 2009, 2010 kids graduate, the eligible college-age student pool is going to drop by 40%. Because 2008, 2009 was the big recession. Everybody couldn't afford houses. People were losing jobs. Inflation was crazy. And as a result, people were not having kids. So the birth rates dropped so dramatically that now that we're coming into the college cycle years, we're going to be down 40% bodies. Imagine
wow.
the effect that's going to have.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That's just straight up demographics. That's going to have a shattering effect. So you better backlog some kids now in order to carry them on because it's going to be hard to come by
Phil, is there in your competitive situation, is there as much portal action there as there is in Division I with the big schools or not?
Oh, sure. The portal is the worst mistake, in my eyes, the NCAA has ever made because we're doing exactly what the people want. We're giving them their way. They can leave whenever they want to leave. They can leave for no reason. They can just move on. Everybody's picking up kids off portal, and you know, the kids may have some baggage, either disciplinary or academic. It's like, okay, you know, we're trying to listen to you guys complain. We're trying to force schools to sign a letter of release to let you talk to somebody else. We're just going to wipe that slate clean, and we're going to give you the opportunity to go wherever you want, whenever you want. It doesn't matter. Just do it.
Bill, yeah. I want to thank you as always. Sorry we got on to you a little bit late today, but thank you very, very much. Look forward to, as we go down the line, getting closer to the winter meetings, getting close to the season opening up. We're certainly looking forward to having you back on with us many times.
I look forward to it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Bill, always a pleasure. Bill. You're the best. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Take care, guys. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
You too.
He
hey,
does
Don,
more games.
You know what? That game we saw last night, talking about just what Bill was talking about on the portal, did you see that one kid? He's played on four different colleges teams.
That's right.
That was unbelievable. I mean, one was a junior college, but my gosh, four teams? That's a little too much for me.
Well, he got something to play on five teams. That's not the top of the rung. But anyway, you're exactly right, Roger. I mean, everybody, you know, we talk about student athletes, and they're playing on five different schools to play basketball or play football or whatever. But Mike Schulte is going to join us next. Mike, of course, always talks about the NCAA, talks about the bowl. He'll talk about that this evening as well. Mike, welcome back to the show once again. And a lot of important games, not necessarily big games this week. Last week there were some very big games. Penn State was one with Michigan. We talked last week about the situation with Harbaugh and what was going to happen, and that happened before the Saturday game, and not very clearly defined either. It was, I don't know, but anyway, we talked about it last week. Welcome once again, Mike, and what do you think this week? Any major surprises this week?
Well, you know our saying, every week something happens you don't expect, and I expect that'll be the case this week again. You know, you mentioned big games. You know, there's big games that are the national sort of, you know, two top 10 teams playing each other kind of games. And then there's big games that, you know, are really important to the schools that are playing. And I do think we have quite a few of those now, especially to the point where, you know, we're down to the final, basically 2 weeks of the regular season. And now is when, you know, these games, if nothing else, they mean a lot. I'm talking college football, of course. They mean an awful lot in regards to the potential post-game opportunities for these teams. You have some teams, a number of teams that are trying to get bowl eligible. You've got teams, you know, and how they finish these last two games can make a world of difference with a team as to what kind of a bowl game they get into, what kind of bowl trip they're going to have if they do qualify. Because there's a big difference between, you know, 6-6 and where you might go and say, you know, 8-4 or whatever the case may be. So you know, these games are really important to them. And even for the teams that are more at the top of the rung, if you will, you know, positioning for the college football rankings that, you know, of course the latest ones just came out last night. And, you know, there's some teams there that, you know, you look at the rankings and you're like, okay, but knowing that, you know, what's ahead based on upcoming games and in both regular season and potential conference championship games, you know, there's going to be some movement in those rankings. And, you know, you got a lot of teams vying to get into that four-team playoff right now. And I could probably give you eight teams right now that could potentially be in that mix, depending on what they do in the next 2 weeks in the conference championship games. So there's still a lot of football left to be played, and the outcomes can be, pretty significantly different, depending on how these teams do. And even if it's a game where there's, you know, they're going to be favored and they're supposed to win the game, you know, we see upsets all the time. I mean, my son goes to UCF, and we were over there in Orlando for that game against number 15 Oklahoma State last weekend. And not only did they beat Oklahoma State, they won, I think it was like 45-3 or something like that. I mean, it was just nobody saw that coming, right? And so all of a sudden Oklahoma State, you know, drops 10 spots in the polls and that kind of thing. So things can happen. And, you know, some of these games are definitely games where, you know, if the favored team doesn't come ready to play and, you know, they could end up walking away with a loss that they didn't expect.
Roger.
Yeah, last weekend I was up at my daughter's, and she lives an hour from State College. And I'll tell you what, Mike, the price of hotel rooms in Salem's Grove, Pennsylvania, was like out of sight at a Marriott, $400 to $500 for the night, Friday night, and then same thing at Saturday night, but. What I found interesting, my daughter and son-in-law both went to Bucknell. He played football at Bucknell. And they have so much construction, and they're in the Patriot League. So they're building an indoor practice facility. They're building all new locker rooms. They have a artificial field that's a turf. I mean, not the one in the stadium, the one that's outside the stadium. And
yeah,
it just goes
one, yeah.
to show. Yeah, practice one. Yeah, and it just goes to show you, even at that level, how much college football means to a university as far as prestige, publicity, promotion, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, you look at what happened with Colorado this year, and I know that
you know, I think they're about around 500 right now, which, mm-hmm. you know, still a huge improvement over what they have been and what they were last year. I think a year ago they only won one game. But, you know, with all the stuff.
Prime time is getting a lot of publicity there. I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, the team's not doing too well,
but the prime time is getting a lot of publicity.
Well, no, the team's doing good. Hey, any other program, you take it from one win to six or seven wins, you know, you think that's a heck of a success, right?
That's true.
I mean,
yeah.
But do that when you got to bring in 80 new players. I mean, you know, they didn't just, you know, improve their team. They had to start from scratch with guys
right.
that never played before, you know, but together. But my point in that is that the university, the numbers I saw, and I can't remember exactly, but it was something to the effect of the university, their social media following went from, like, for football or the university went from, like, 100,000 followers to, you know, 3 million followers. And the amount of money that the program had brought in donations was tens of millions of dollars ahead of anything they've ever done before, and et cetera,
right.
et cetera, et cetera. And this was like, you know, this was as of like a month ago, right? So the point in all that the other thing, applications skyrocketed for people applying to school there this year. So, you know, to speak what you were talking about, the impact that a program can have, a successful program can have on a university is undeniable. And, you know, so you're seeing that, like you said, at every level.
Right. So they're going to play Friday night this week, so everybody got a chance to see. I believe their game is Friday night. They're not playing on Saturday. I believe they're playing Friday night. But another very, very important game is North Carolina-Clemson because, you know, what a game North Carolina played last week in overtime, double overtime, and Max finally won it. But what a terrific game at Chapel Hill. I don't know whether you had a chance to see it or not, Mike.
I didn't get to watch it, but I did hear about it. And you're right, that is a big game for both those squads. Louisville and Miami play, I believe, this week as well. That's a big game for both of those guys. You know, and Louisville's trying to, you know, they're trying to get into the ACC championship game. I'm not sure if they're slotted in that yet or not, but they, but also, you know, right now they're ranked pretty high and have a chance to possibly play FSU in that game. And who knows what will happen from there. So, you know, but obviously they've got to get by Miami first. So, and I'll tell you another interesting game is going to be Tennessee at Georgia. Will be an interesting game. So or Georgia at Tennessee, rather. So, you know, that, you know, will that be another upset kind of thing like Georgia did or Tennessee did last year against Alabama and they tore the goalpost down and put it and threw it in a river? I don't know, but that's going to be a big game for those guys. You know, and Georgia is number one
well,
right now.
Well, before we run out of time,
we've
got a lot of time left, but let's give your bowl a little bit of publicity and talk about the tickets, talk about the opportunity that the kids have, give a little impression around the country of what the bowl is all about and New Year's Day.
Sure. Well, the ReliaQuest Bowl in Tampa is looking forward to another great year this year. Our tickets are actually going on sale on Monday at 10 a.m. Monday at Ticketmaster. So people can start buying tickets then. We're looking forward to a great matchup of potential, you know, Big Ten versus the SEC. We might have an ACC team actually, as opposed to Big Ten, depending on how the playoff committee assigns teams to the Orange Bowl. But either way, we're going to have a really nice matchup, and we've got a great week of events leading up to the game. It's just a great environment, a great way to start the new year. So tickets are going on sale Monday at 10 a.m. on Ticketmaster, and we're looking forward to having a great show for everybody.
And we're all looking forward to the ReliaQuest Bowl as well. Roger, you're up.
Well, I know you guys always do. I haven't ever been in attendance, but I'm sure it will be. And, you know, it's going to be interesting talking about that Georgia-Tennessee game this week, because you know, Georgia's had some ups and downs. And, you know, they're, as you mentioned, they're back number one. However, Tennessee looks pretty good. And I guess this is the next step will be against Alabama in the conference championship, depending on what happens this weekend, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, Georgia and Alabama, I think, have both solidified their spots in the SEC championship game. And, of course, you know, that's going to be a huge, huge game, if for no other reason than, you know, with the playoff, obviously. You know, if Georgia does get by Tennessee and goes in undefeated, and Alabama gets by their next two games, including Auburn and the Iron Bowl, then, you know, you're going to have a huge game that's probably going to have probably number one Georgia versus maybe a number seven or eight Alabama at that point, and maybe even higher. And, you know, obviously it's going to make a big difference in regards to what four teams get in playoff. And if Alabama were to win that game, and it's a close game, then you could see potentially two SEC teams in the playoff again, like we had a couple of years ago. So, you know, there's a lot riding on these games. And like you said, and no matter who they're playing, you know, if you're a favorite, you need to take care of business and win the game you're supposed to win. And otherwise, you've got to keep getting the W's to get a really good bowl spot. So there's a lot riding on these last few weeks of games, regardless of who you're playing each week.
Well, you explained the James Madison situation. We talked about it at great length last week. And they're still undefeated. And they're an 7 or 8 point favorite this weekend to clean the slate at an undefeated. And as you explained, if there's spots open, they are going to get a chance to play, even though, according to the rules, there has to be a room for them to play in a bowl in order to go there.
Yeah, I think so. So they actually just got a ruling, I guess, today or yesterday, I saw that they're not – it's the strangest thing. I'm not sure why it is this way, but it's what the rules are, the NCAA –
they're not in.
Evidently, they are not eligible to play in the Sun Belt Conference Championship game. However, if there's not enough teams to fill all the contracted bowl slots this year, then they can be one of the teams to fill one of those empty spots. So, so it's, you know, like you said, I don't make the rules. I just, but it has something to do obviously with their transition into the FBS level bowl of football. And,
correct.
Again, I'm not really understanding why they have that kind of rule in place, but I've sort of always figured that, you know, once you're in, you're in, but maybe there's some kind of probationary period during the transition process or something. I'm not sure.
They make some strange rules, I'll tell you.
They were James Madison was in the CAA, Colonial Athletic Conference, for a number of years because I used to do games when they'd be playing Drexel women in basketball. And I just saw the other night that the coach then, Kenny Brooks, is now the women's coach at Va Tech. So, that's a pretty big program. But, Mike, that's what we said before. It's all because the existing schools want a chance to win, and they don't want the Johnny-come-lately, the new boy on the block, to block them that first year. That's the probationary period, and James.
But Roger,
Madison,
you got an undefeated team. I mean, I just don't understand how you can eliminate an undefeated team from being in a conference championship, much less going into the NCAA tournament. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. You're supposed to be. This is supposed to be education and I'll never understand some of the rules they make. It's crazy.
It's politics, because James Madison's had a good football program at the division or 1AA level, I call it. And they,
right.
You remember when Villanova won the national championship, but like the next couple of years, James Madison, I think, won the championship. So they have had quite a reputation or a college football for a long time, and that's why they made the move. But you know, going from the CAA to the Sun Belt Conference is a big step forward for the school, and
right.
and probably for the league too, the conference.
Mike, have you got a
Still
dark
politics.
Horse for us? You got a dark horse for us, Mike, for team you think may step up and take charge of the Final Four? You think Michigan, I guess, is going to
Harbaugh can't
coach the next three games, but he can coach the playoffs.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You mean a dark horse for the – you mean a dark horse
yeah,
to get in the playoff?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well – I don't know this is going to happen, but
none of us do.
possibly, but keep an eye out. You know, potentially there's a scenario where Texas could get in, and that would be interesting. Now it would take a couple of things happening, but I would say that would be a dark horse kind of potential pick. It would be Texas getting in with one loss, winning the Big 12. Because right now, right ahead of them, and just outside of the playoff, you have Washington, who's undefeated, and you have Oregon, who's undefeated, or has one loss, I'm sorry. And then you have both of them have to play Oregon State coming up, and then if they both win out the next couple of weeks, then Washington and Oregon will play each other in the Pac-12 championship game. And so if it would be interesting to see
down to the last weekend of the season.
Yeah, let's just say Oregon State beats Oregon and this week or next week, whenever they play, and then Oregon turns around and beats Washington in the championship game. Texas and Texas wins their conference championship, they might slide right up into one of those playoff spots, with the idea that Ohio State and Michigan have to play each other, and one of those guys obviously will lose that game.
Right.
And if that might knock them out of the playoff, and might be an opening for Texas. So that's my dark horse pick.
Well, Mike, once again, thank you very much. Tickets, you said. Let's go over that very quickly. Tickets are now on sale, correct?
No, they're on sale on Monday. So Monday they go on sale at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster. Yep.
Okay. And you'll join us next week, and we'll update everybody on where it stands.
That sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Have a great week,
Mike. And watch some football.
Appreciate it. Yep,
thank you thank you very, very much. Mike Schulte joins us every week, NCAA, and, of course, the Orlando Quest Bowl, New Year's Day. We always get over there and see that. Hopefully we're going to get there to see it again this year. But now we're going to get on to Baltimore, Washington, and talk to the PGA professional that joins us week in and week out, Doug Hamilton. Doug Hamilton, before we talk about any golf, we got to talk about the closing seconds of last Sunday's game with the Ravens.
Oh, why? What happened? I think I accidentally turned the TV off. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. You got to stick for the whole pro. You got to stick for the whole program, my boy.
Yeah, it's pretty painful. I mean, I think most things Cleveland are repugnant. I don't like. It's a terrible. I mean, it's really a terrible city. It's they call it the mistake by the lake. So I don't really.
Their quarterback today.
Well, that's what $260 million will get you guaranteed. So I bet you they're really happy they did that. That was a really good idea, I think. But The game started off really well. I mean, the Ravens have lost three times this year, and in all three cases they've relinquished a lead, a sizable lead, at some point in the second half. And I'm not sure. I mean, just watching that game, that was unfortunate that, you know, Lamar Jackson threw the football and it got batted, and then that guy picked it off and ran it in. But that was the momentum changer. From that point forward, they really couldn't do much, and you could just see it happening. And, you know, there was a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel when the Cleveland kicker missed the extra point, thinking, okay, well, you know, we're still winning. But then, you know, that last second field goal was enough to, you know, kind of make me say a few choice words and just, you know, it was really an awful football day, you know, at least from my concern of watching the Ravens lose last second. You know, my wife is a Commanders fan, so they lost, you know, with a late field goal. And all in all, my fantasy football team was stinky because I didn't put the right people in, and that was upsetting. So it was kind of a crummy Sunday, but yeah.
Roger?
But there's always next week.
Well, I keep telling myself that, but I told
Thursday
myself that.
Thursday night, right. It's tomorrow night, not next week, right? There. Tomorrow night, they got their three and a half point choice over the Bengals.
Thursday night football games stink. I mean, you give a team a couple days to prepare. You know, they're still trying to Monday, Tuesday lick their wounds from, you know, the battle scars they had on Sunday. You've got, you know, the possibility of, I mean, Ronnie Stanley, their left tackle, has already been ruled out. I think Marlon Humphrey's on the fence. I don't know if he's questionable or doubtful. Either way, trending downward. But, you know, unfortunately, you see these things happen with the violent collisions and the amount of tackles and hits and things that these guys take on Sunday. And then you're going to ask them to, you know, basically take a cold plunge on, you know, after the game and you know, suit up a couple days later. I mean, the good news is it's a division rival, so that, you know, from a preparation standpoint, it's not like you don't know them. But, you know, I think you've got the Bengals coming off a tough loss against Houston. They didn't particularly look well, but,
right,
you know, they have their own. I mean, T. Higgins is not playing. There's a couple other. They have some injuries at the wide receiver position, but Ja'Marr Chase is a pretty dynamic player, and their defense isn't terrible. So Joe Burrow is Joe Burrow. I mean, he's – you know, he can go out there and they can put a 40 spot. I mean, I know, Don, you're what's the over-under on this? I mean, this could be a shootout.
46.
That's solid for an NFL game. But, I mean, I'd like to think that game – I mean, if the Browns can – you know, the Ravens-Browns was, what, 60-couple points they scored, you know. And I think the Ravens actually have a decent defense. I mean, they get after the quarterback, which is something they – didn't do in the Wink Martindale era. You know, and the back end of their secondary is played particularly well. They have some really ginormous men up front that play the run well, that guy Michael Pierce and some other guys that do well. I don't know how Cleveland got that many points. You know, they didn't look very good. And, you know, I think before the ink dried, Deshaun Watson looked like a terrible quarterback. I don't think he's played hardly any good games for Cleveland. You know, since they signed him, but we'll see what happens. I mean, I'll obviously be a spectator watching the game and hoping that the Ravens can. This would be a big win for them to win against the Bengals and sweep them. So we'll see.
Roger? Hello, Roger.
He's going. He had to go to the bathroom.
I don't know where Roger left. Where Roger left. I'll tell you, though. The funny thing was, there were so many games last week. They were either terrible games or they were games that came right down to the wire, like your game, like the Ravens.
Yep.
And
yep, there were a bunch.
Yeah, five games.
I mean,
really.
This is the first year that I haven't had the Sunday ticket because I've always had DirecTV, so I've always had the luxury, if you will, you know, catching parts of different games that wouldn't otherwise be televised.
Right.
But, I mean, you look at some of these games they have on Thursdays and Sunday nights and Monday nights, and, I mean, you know, like the Raiders are a bad football team. The Jets are a bad football team. Buffalo doesn't look very good at all.
How about that? They were picking.
Yeah,
up.
Jets are a bad football team, except their defense is good. You know what happened is I had dropped off and I just came back. I don't know what happened. My line dropped. But I wanted to get back, Doug, what you said about Thursday night games. My answer is that you have the teams on Thursday night that had the off weekend because of a bye. And then that way, that gives them, like, they finish on Thursday night, they practice that week, but they had a week off, and then they get a week and a half to recover. If you do it way, I have no problem with Thursday night games.
Totally agree. I mean, look, at the end of the day, I don't know how the schedule actually gets made, whether it's, you know, some kid that drops a deck of cards and they just flip them over and say, hey, this week this team's going to – but – you know, for me, it's, you know, you have the start of the season where you start looking at some of these teams, and I mean, we don't know what injuries are going to play out that are going to change the course of the season that now make a good team a bad team and et cetera, you know what I mean? But there's some really awful, you know, matchups that happen. And then you look at those Sunday
Well, what happened
games
was, is the fact that they scheduled in the Giants, who they thought were going to be competitive, the Jets, who they thought were going to be competitive with Rodgers. They scheduled in so many primetime games with those kinds of teams who turned out to be terrible because either they lost players because of injury or they weren't any good to begin with.
Well, you had the Sunday morning game was the Colts and the Patriots. I mean, the only people that liked that were the people in Germany because they don't know what football is. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's just
and now they're not interested in a franchise, Doug.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, Jacksonville ought to be setting up a headquarters somewhere across the pond soon, you know, as much as they play over there.
Well, so. I said I'll use the same one I used last week. Last week was supposedly going to be a good game between Kansas City and Kansas City and Miami, I think it was. And I said that was the first game I got up to watch on Sunday morning, and it will be the last game I get up to watch on Sunday morning. I'm not watching games at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I think I actually enjoy that. I kind of look forward. It actually elongates your day on Sundays if you have interest in football. But, I mean, look at Kansas City. I mean, they haven't been a very good football team this year in terms of, you know, they've won some squeakers. But, I mean, like, you know, they've lost. Their offense doesn't look the same as it used to. I mean, you know, this
Roger brought that point up earlier in the show that he thought, you know, they weren't necessarily a number one team in the NFL.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I mean, people can talk – you know, a lot about the AFC and who they think, you know, they represent. I mean, they were before the season, I think you probably had Kansas City, Buffalo, and the Bengals. One of those three was the next anointed crowned, you know, team that was going to be dominant. And I think if the Ravens can get their defense under wraps in terms of holding on to these, they should be 10-0. And I think that the Baltimore Ravens, I think that they have the ability to be the best team in the AFC. You know, people talked about, you know, this new offense and Todd Monken and Lamar Jackson, and he can't pass the football, and I don't know, you know, why are we giving all this money? I mean, he has a completion percentage of north of 70%, you know, so, I mean, something's working. You know, their run game is still their run game. I think that
their defense is good, though.
Their defense is better. They have a number of players who have sacks in McDonald's scheme. Where he brings pressure and does different things. And the back end of that secondary has held up enough based on the pressure that he puts on there. Because for those that don't know, I mean, Wink Martindale, I liked him as a defensive coordinator, but his scheme was more blitz heavy as opposed to, you know, just different things that this guy does to bring pressure from different places.
Well, he's having a tough time with the Giants. Of course, they don't have much talent, too. Had time too, but
yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, the addition of Roquan Smith has made all the world to the Ravens since they've acquired him. I mean, he's a tackling machine. Patrick Queen standing next to him is playing very good, inspired football. Obviously, it's a contract year for him, which Justin Matabike is another one, defensive lineman that the Ravens have contract year. So there's, you know, Both playing really, really good football, but, you know, it's tough to pay all these different guys, you know, when it comes to the, you know, the amount of money they make. So,
hey,
Roger.
Doug, getting back to Jacksonville, and you're right about how many times they played overseas. I guess they were probably the first team that really played over there. But I think that's all changing because they just weren't drawing. You know, in a, 75,000 to 80,000 seat stadium, the Gator Bowl.
Yeah.
And now that they have a good team and a growing team, I don't think that they're going to want to play. They're going to want to keep that in-house now that they are back in the house in that stadium for the team. And what do you guys think about that? I that's the way I think about it.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's, you can see this in a lot of different sports. You know, you guys are part and parcel to the Tampa Bay, you know, scenario where you've got a winning baseball team that doesn't draw, you know, an exorbitant amount of fans. I mean, Jacksonville's kind of the same concept where, you know, they're starting to win. They're starting, you know, they've got the pieces of Trevor Lawrence and ETN and the pieces of, you know, a core group of guys. Their defense is pretty decent. You know, I think that owner probably is a good owner in terms of what he wants to spend and do and all these different things. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's some teams in some markets that just aren't cut out to have, you know, professional sports teams. You know, it's just the way that it works. I mean, we've seen that in
well,
different
Well, if Lawrence could figure out which uniform to throw his ball to.
Well,
he'd have
he struggled last week for sure.
He'd have a better chance. But, he can't. He came out of college as the number one draft choice. He was the guy that was going to turn the program around, and I still think he's going to. I think he is a quality quarterback. He just had some bad luck, but he just throws right now. He's just throwing too many interceptions.
Let's give that credit to where it should be. I mean, San Francisco's a pretty daggone good defense when you can spot, you know, Chase Young and Nick Bosa coming at you. That's enough to make a lot of people want to, you know, go grab an ice cream cone at halftime and say, I'm done.
You got that,
well,
you got that
Jacksonville's
right.
Got a great coach now, too. I mean, he's a Super Bowl winner and a class act, and you couldn't ask for a better coach and representative of that team in the community than Doug Peterson.
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, there's some people have that special talent of being, as they would say in air quotes, a quarterback whisperer when it comes to developing talent and those sorts of things. And, you know, it seems like I said, I mean, they're a building, you know, franchise and, you know, there's some good things that are going to happen, you know, with them.
And you
so
know what,
Brandon
Doug, there's
Hyde,
some that don't
you gotta
have
be happy
that talent.
Brandon Hyde got the Manager of the Year award.
Well, it's, you know, look, I can appreciate the fact that the Orioles have some different things that wrapped up the end of their season with Gunnar Henderson and Brandon Hyde and Mike Elias. I mean, that's a pretty solid, you know, threesome of different things that happened in a positive light. I mean, my curiosity is I counted it two or three different times today, but the 40-man roster for the Orioles stands at 36. So I'm curious to know, I know the Rule 5 draft is coming up, and I know that, I don't know the particulars, but I don't know from their minor league system, there's a certain caliber of player. I don't know if it's years experience, or I'm not sure how that equation comes together that they have to protect, or else they, you know, they let them available for that Rule 5 draft. I don't know if the Orioles are going to, they left four spots because they're going to take some people, or I'm not sure what they're doing there. So that has my curiosity.
Roger?
Well, I'll tell you, Doug, the Orioles are not the only team that have open spots. I think the Phillies have 38.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives them some leverage. And, of course, you know, Aaron Nola and Rhys Hoskins opted out for free agency. I wanted to, get back. You had a great point, you know, when we were talking about Doug Peterson. And you said there are people that are really good. They know what they're doing. And I agree, Doug Peterson. And then on the flip side, there are people who have no clue, i.e. Josh McDaniel. Does anybody think Josh McDaniel will ever get a head coaching shot again? I don't.
Yeah, but that unto itself, Roger, is a very valid point, because what you see is you see a lot of these people that resurface after having a failed, you know, attempt. I don't certainly want to sound like a hypocrite based on my recent track record of PGA professional. But at the same time, you know, I think the guys like McDaniel and people that fall under that Belichick coaching tree, maybe it's Andy Reid, you know, different people will continue to get opportunities before other people do because of they think their pedigree. And to me, if you look at McDaniel, I mean, he was not a good football coach in Denver. He was actually better probably in Denver. Certainly not in Los Angeles. And then he totally stiffed the Colts, you know, when they hired him and he declined, like whenever that
right.
middle of night or whatever that happened was.
Right.
And that's to my point is that some of these people are better designed as offensive coordinators, defensive coordinators. You know, what was the other guy? Matt Patricia, another guy, the Lions. He didn't last very long. I mean, a lot of these guys.
He's on the staff at the Eagles now as, you know, at a low man. But you know what? The other thing is McDaniel had Brady. And mm-hmm. when he lost Brady, the whole team has lost. And they're drafting and everything since Brady left.
Well, I'm not going to say that these individuals aren't good football coaches, but from what I understand, based on Josh McDaniel, that he just wasn't a good person. And I think that had more to do with...
Oh, that's exactly right. You're right about that. He was following,
you know,
like Belichick, and Belichick can get away with it, but Josh McDaniel can't.
Well, I mean, look at the – I say this every time I watch a football game. That the Miami Dolphins head coach, that guy looks like he looks like he, on every, like, Thursday night, has, like, a glass of water, and then he organizes his butterfly collection. Like, he's the biggest nerdy-looking guy. And
he is,
if you open
right.
one of those books – my mom gave me one of those books when I was, like, 12 – for Christmas, the Where's Waldo book. That's that dude, I'm telling you. He's Waldo.
But so, he's a good coach.
I mean, he knows his stuff, but I'm just saying, like, I mean, how about the guy in Los Angeles for the Chargers? I mean, he's kind of on some thin ice, I think, a little bit. I mean, but there's...
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
You know? So.
But, you know, look at... But then you look at the Eagles... with Nick, and here his first two coordinators are both head coaches in the league, and he's only in his third year or fourth year as the head coach of the Eagles.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I had a pair of shoulder pads and a helmet, and you said you can go play for any coach you want to go play for, I might pick Dan Campbell. I think that guy's a
he's great. He's a player's coach.
I just like his. They're
he's really a hard-nosed coach too, boy. He's taking that team from sawdust to the big leagues.
Yeah, I mean, I like how he does what he does. He's very passionate. I love watching him on the sidelines, encourage his players, and, you know, get after that. It's just it's fun.
And he was that way as a player too. I remember him playing. Yeah.
He said that himself in the interview where they were talking about it. He actually cried during the interview because he said, "Look, man, I was good enough to make the league, but I was the bottom end of the NFL. Like I had to."
Producer Frank Carl tells me we're all through. Never even got to golf today with our PGA professional Doug Hamilton, but we'll get you next week, Doug. Thank you very much.
Got it.
Doug, have a great week. Take care.
Roger, thank you. Thanks to all our guests tonight, and a lot of fun, a lot of good stuff. And we'll do it all again next Wednesday night. Thank you. All yours, Frank.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this program brought to you each and every night of the week. We're grateful for you. The men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of Peace and Fire Services, the doctors and nurses at the hospital, and the first responders of COVID. Please, when you see somebody in uniform, let them know you know they're there. If you can, say you appreciate it. It would be well within make them the happiest guys in the world. These programs are set dedicated to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Dr. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazlitz, Detective Patrolman Jeffrey Colcott, Patrolman David Curtis, Sergeant Thomas Pager, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Henler, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Harper Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Fire Department, Police Department, Sergeant Chris LeVake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Anofu Crispin, Lakeland PD, Lieutenant Joe Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Artis Hoke, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Chelsea Richard, Florida Highway Patrol, Chief Al Hogle, Longwood Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Blaine Lane, and then Deputy Chris Myers, Polk County Sheriff's Department, and Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Sheriff's Department, and Temple University Police Department. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise out to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields, the sunshine lighten on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the palm of his hands. Good night. God bless and have a great week.
Spirit and with mind aflame.
County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 is responding to his last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed.